Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, part two of my interview with the television creator, legend, Norman Lear, and fascinating life, both politically involved in this country, culturally, and welcome, Norman. So let's talk about Donald Trump a little bit, because he is a product of television. Les Moonves, the head of CBS, the same network you worked for during the campaign, he said, you know, Donald Trump may not be good for America, but he's great for CBS. He's great for CBS. Bring it on. Bring it on, you know, the ratings and so forth. So you, a man who reinvented television and, you know, great comedy, but you made it, in the best sense of the word, responsible, concerned, educational, in the best sense, not the boring sense, but in the best sense, exciting sense. And here's a guy who comes along. Yes, we could say television is great, but it's also not always great. And bullying, as represented by Donald Trump, was celebrated by television. I would think that's the main characteristic of, you know, a show like The Apprentice and so forth. And it takes this guy to the presidency. He's a creature of television. What is your appraisal of him?
You know, as I hear you say that, I'm thinking, it had to come to this. This fixation on short-term thinking and what's good for this moment. And he's the ultimate example of that. He seemed like, you know, if you want to say fuck you, and you with the middle finger of the right hand, to go back to that metaphor, it happens in a flash, you know. You think it, you do it, you mean it from the bottom of your heart, you know, boom, take that. And I honestly think the American people were saying, take that, you know, and they gave us the worst example of that was running. The best example of the worst was running, and they said, take that. And I look around today, and there isn't sufficient reason to change your mind. If you are living an emotionally crowded, difficult, economically life, you know, somebody working your ass off with a couple, three kids you adore, worried about their future, living, you know, as I don't know what percentage of Americans are living, finding it so difficult. And for no fault of their own. I mean, there are people, I'm hearing the people in my head that were with Carl with no fault of their own. But too many are born into it.
We live in a class-divided society that I suspect when you came out of the Army, because I'm old enough to remember, I was a young kid, you know, you got a bunch of years on me, but I remember the optimism, you know, with Levittown, with the little houses, you know, the jobs were coming back, opportunity, you know, this, you know, yes, it civil rights movement was starting as a reminder that they weren't going to get a break and women were, you know, kept in paid less. And so we all know the imperfections, but there was a feeling that this country, the old de Tocqueville celebration of an ever expanding middle class and opportunity and the public schools working. And you had that. And now we've accepted a situation where just a large number of people, because they use public schools, the thing we loved, they use, oh, those are not good. You got to send your kid to a special private school, and you got to know somebody who'll get you that advantage. And what you just said is really the key thing. The fact is, these people got screwed for the last 20 years because of policies that were followed. We know that, you know, that freed Wall Street greed and so forth. And one of the things I've always liked about you, Norman, is you are deliberately nonpartisan. You're not indifferent, but you're nonpartisan. I remember you got me to support a guy, John Anderson, who was an independent Republican from, I think, Rockville, Illinois or something. You've always been, you know, hey, our friends can be up to bad stuff. Our friends can be doing mischief. And I think
I like hearing that. Thank you.
No, but I mean,
hope that's true.
But you were, I mean.
But John Anderson, I do, of course, remember John Anderson.
Yeah, but I remember all along. Well, when you're even reaching out to John Wayne or reaching out to Gerald Ford.
Well, Reagan. Remember our history, yours and mine, with Ronald Reagan?
Just to set the stage, because it is sort of historically interesting. I had interviewed the first President Bush when he was running. He was running against Reagan. And I had interviewed him after he won the Iowa primary. This was for the 1980 election. On that, he had said that he believed that you could win a nuclear war. That was the controversy. And then I did the interview.
Well, we have a president right now.
Yeah, I understand. We'll get to that in a minute. But what happened then was, and I was, for the Los Angeles Times, I was then interviewing Reagan, and I had been conducting these interviews over, you know, because they're busy and you got to hit 20 minutes here and a half out there. And then you had the idea to send a television crew. And the Reagan people accepted it. They were on the plane and they allowed this portion. And the grilling was about winnable nuclear war. And did the Russians believe in it and their fallout shelters and all that stuff. And I must say, I had met Reagan much earlier because when he was running for governor, I had interviewed him for Ramparts magazine. And again, I found he was a guy who would talk to you and he was confident in his views and he didn't pull rank. I actually have very fond memories of Reagan as an individual in that regard. So when you set this thing up, and I think you got their permission. You knew Nancy, right? You knew
yes.
Ronald Reagan, right? And so there was your crew on the plane. And that normally would make a candidate very nervous. You know, why is this being televised by this crazy guy, Scheer, and I'm talking to him, and I got Norman Lear's crew here. And he was not flummoxed at all about this. And he handled himself. He stated his position, and he obviously believed it. You know, and it was quite amazing. And he had also been briefed, you know, that we could shoot down these things. And Edward Teller, who he was close to, had believed we could have Star Wars defense. So it was an important exchange. And as I recall, you knew Nancy quite well. Did you know Ronald?
Well, as a result of, I don't remember how. I did know Nancy quite well enough that she invited me to present to her when a group representing, there's a John Wayne Hospital somewhere in Texas, and they were honoring Nancy at the Beverly Hilton Hotel. The only time I've ever been in a ballroom with tuxedoed men in 10-gallon hats. I'll never forget that. And Nancy asked me to present her that evening, and I did. She and Parencio, Jerry Parencio, my long-term partner who passed recently and was an ardent Republican, they were flying up to Ronald Reagan's memorial at the library and invited me to come along. So I sat with Nancy and Jerry at his memorial. I could have been the only I was thinking to say the only liberal, but I consider myself a bleeding heart conservative. I don't think of myself as a liberal because I think you will not mess with my Bill of Rights, my Declaration, my Constitution, my First Amendment. I think that's as conservative as you can get, you know, if you really mean it. Then comes the question of affording equal opportunity and equal justice and so forth. That's where all the work comes in. And my heart bleeds in that direction.
But again, sticking to this nonpartisan or you know, I know you've taken some heat for it. And it's interesting because it's very easy to demonize the other side and, you know, virtue is all on your side. And I think one of your great strengths, after all in the family. You took a conservative, right, Archie Bunker, and you had him be human, you know, and you tried to understand what made him tick. And that's why the show has such great credibility. Conservative people enjoyed watching that show, you know, because he raised a lot of their concerns. And I think we've gotten into a place where we think many people I know, they seem to think the Democratic Party is the center of virtue. And it's true, we don't have too many moderate Republicans around in the mold of Dwight Eisenhower or some of the other folks, but it's too easy. And I was just wondering about how you regarded this last election. I mean, you had Bernie Sanders, who not that different than you, actually, another old Jew, right, from back east, and raising a whole bunch of questions. And then you had the anointed candidate, Hillary Clinton, and, you know, how did you look at that whole political choice? And
the American people, those suffering, and I always think of it in emotionally crowded lives, as I try to imagine what it would be to live like most Americans have to live and struggle to keep a roof over your head and your kids in school and their future, and then, oh, my God, and not find leadership. You know, I was spoke at the Bohemian Grove. You know about what the Bohemian Grove is.
Yeah, that's where rich men gather and they piss on redwood trees.
Largely Republican and you know, several thousand. And it was, and I talked about, you mentioned Dwight Eisenhower. And I said, this was when 17 people were running for the Republican nomination. And I said, why do I never hear the name Dwight David Eisenhower? 5-star general, led us through World War II, 2-term Republican president, responsible for the interstate highway system. You know, it kept us out of several other near wars. There are people who find fault with him, but he was all of what I just mentioned, and he's never, ever, you never hear his name invoked by 17 people running. You hear Reagan and Reagan and Reagan, and you hear Bush, Bush, Bush. You hear even Gerald Ford, but you don't hear why. And the reason was he warned us about the military-industrial complex that I think is choking us to death now. And in his first draft, which I saw, I don't remember how I saw or heard at his library in Kansas, he called it the military-industrial congressional complex.
One of my bravest actions as a child was wearing a I Like Ike button in the Bronx. I never even met a Republican, but I liked this guy. And I.F. Stone, who was this columnist I used to read in the, I forget the name of the paper, the PM or something, one of the newspapers in New York, the legendary journalist, he came out for Ike. And I.F. Stone argued, this guy knows war. He's a general. And we need peace. We need somebody. And Eisenhower was, by the way, against dropping the nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He said it was not justified, it was not necessary. He was opposed to it. And he was very concerned about the misuse of military power. The irony
Look at that, the Republican president, the Republican was against the dropping of the bombs, and the haberdasher Democrat.
Yeah.
Dropped
the bombs. And by the way, it's interesting because it was supposed to be to save guys like you, right? You were involved in the war and so forth. And one of my great heroes, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, the great beat poet, happened to be anti-sub commander in Normandy and everything. Another guy with war experience. And then they shipped him off to Japan. And he visited Nagasaki after the bombing. And that devastation is what, you know, he, again, like with others, it turned him into a lifetime pacifist. He was just so shocked. And yet his life was supposed to be saved by dropping the bomb, basically killing civilians. These were not military targets. Norman, you're 95 years old. It's just almost going to be a century. I'm going to be there when, you know, unless I kick off before, I'm going to be there when we celebrate your century of life. You were born in 22, just a few years after the end of World War I, for God's sake. You saw World War II. You've been fighting the good fight, you know, both creatively, you know, and politically and so forth and everything. Did you ever imagine we'd be at this moment now with Donald Trump being president?
No, I never imagined. But That doesn't mean I don't believe I understand. I really believe what I've been saying. The American people didn't want what's going on now. And they didn't vote for what's going on now. They voted against what led up to what's going on now. And as I watch the Republicans, as we sit here now, they in Washington are shoving this anti-Obamacare bill, which I can't find a good word for even among Republicans. They're doing it, but they're not talking about how great it is for the American people. None of them.
You mean ending Obamacare?
Yes, or eliminating Obamacare in favor of whatever the hell it is, some bill. You can call it Ryan Care. They're not proud of it. I don't hear anybody raving about what's good for America in this bill. They're just pushing the bill to get rid of the other. I mean, the American people are bereft. And in their emotionally crowded lives, they don't have the time to figure it all out. My degree of sophistication, which is not at all as larger as my career would suggest, you know, I struggle myself to understand. I have basic beliefs when I talk about, you know, describe what I mean by being a bleeding heart conservative. Like, I see so clearly what is so great about the America we fought for in World War II, and how little of it is motivating the Congress, Democrats and Republicans.
Time for a break with this conversation with Norman Lear. We'll be right back. We're back with Norman Lear discussing an incredible life in the television industry and political life. You never lost the common touch. That's, and I think, is absolutely critical here, because you never demonized ordinary men. I remember, because I traveled with Jerry Falwell when he was attacking you, and I profiled him and so forth. I interviewed Richard Nixon in 84 and all that. And I had you in my mind. I want to say this. I know you object when I say you're a role model, and you know, but okay, I don't want to get into a big discussion. But I learned from you, you know, from when I first met you, this thing you've been stressing all through this interview. Don't underestimate the average person. Don't underestimate people. And that's what informed your art and is why you were so successful, not just in finding an audience, because you can find an audience by pandering and so forth, but by raising the bar, I think. I mean, if I were to summarize your life, you know, you were the opposite to the Barnum thing, you know, the sucker born every minute. You actually believed in the American people. And I guess people everywhere.
Yeah.
And
everywhere.
And the reason, one reason I'm doing these podcasts, I mean, this is supposed to be a study of American originals, I say, out of the crazy quilt of American culture. And I haven't even asked you, you might want to mention why your father went to jail when you were 9 years old. But we've all got these varied histories. We've all got different religions and different ethnic backgrounds and different. But somehow in this crazy quilt of American life, we have these originals, okay? Some of the people we've talked to about, you know, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, you know, is one example. Another 95-year-old, by the way, who's still going strong. I just saw him a couple of weeks ago. And what I try to capture in these podcasts is, what is it about this American experience that has created these American, whether it's Willie Nelson who I interviewed, or it's Oliver Stone, you know, or other folks. And Dolores Huerta, I interviewed from the farm workers.
Yes. Great. Oh, God. Incredible. She's one of my heroes.
Yeah, and 11 children, and she out there organizing the field.
Do you remember the name Marsha Hunt?
Yeah.
She's going to be 100 on Monday.
Why?
Well, Marsha Hunt was an actress. You have to Google her. You Google her, you're going to find a very pretty woman with a long history of civil rights activities. And I think she suffered the blacklist. If she didn't suffer the blacklist, she was among the people who were most affected by it. And never stopped speaking her mind, never stopped loving the country the way I feel. I mean, she expressed in her way everything I'm talking about. And she's turning 100 on Monday. So I am going to stop by and give her a hug.
People have made fun of Hollywood. They, you know, obviously is the source of all kinds of scandal and stories and so forth. And I came to L.A. in 76. I came out to California to go to graduate school, 59 at Berkeley. But then I came down here when I first met you to work at the L.A. Times in 76. And I must say, I know I've been told I've been naive, but I've met actually not only the most interesting, but really the finest or some of the finest people I've met in this lifetime right here in this much maligned Los Angeles community. And I remember our lunches, you know, with Murph Goldberger, who was actually a major physicist and concerned about nuclear weapons, and Stanley Scheinbaum, who was the police commissioner who fired Daryl Gates over the racism of the police department. He was a regent. And, you know, Warren Beatty, who had the courage to make a movie like Reds and really fascinating people. And there was never really small talk. We were sort of committed to having small talk, but it never was small talk. It was all about saving the world or what's going on. I mean, Harold Willens would be at some of those
meetings. Just thinking about him.
Yeah, and just, you know, this, I could go down. And you mentioned Jeff Cowan, whose father had been head of CBS and who was the head of the Voice of America, I think the second, and Jeff went on to. But these people, whether they were successful, whether they were born rich, whether they made money in Hollywood, whether they had criminals in their background, you know, like your father did, you know, get in trouble and so forth. But the fact of the matter is, and this is where people tell me I'm naive, I always felt idealism, maybe sometimes misplaced idealism, but I always felt idealism, and this is with your first and second wives and everyone else. I mean, a lot of people I've met, my own wife, who was the associate editor of the Times, Nada Zucchino, I mean, the conversations that I, and in your house where you've had one speaker after another, it's been a great forum in Los Angeles, the Lear household, you know, and you bring all these people, and one movement after another, whether it was civil rights, gay rights, women's rights, and so forth, and I felt, hey, wait a minute, out of this den of iniquity of Hollywood and L.A. has come a fountain of idealism. How the hell did that happen?
You know? I wonder if it doesn't exist in every community. This is a community that happens where, you know, I was born in or raised in Hartford, Connecticut, which was an insurance community. They were not celebrated, you know, in the newspapers or radio or television or so forth. But I have to believe that the same ratio of interested and interesting people, of people who are doing exactly what they're, you know, the people in this industry have been doing, some getting caught doing it brilliantly, some getting caught doing it poorly, you know, or doing what they shouldn't do. I don't know. People are people and cultures are cultures, and the culture of Hartford probably at essence, if one studied it, wouldn't be all that different from the culture in Hollywood.
What is the end game? I mean, we are, in your case, approaching a century of life. World War I right now to Donald Trump, and who knows what's coming in the next years. And you keep yourself in good health. You got your mind is, trust me, I interviewed you in 76. Your mind is clearer, and I mean this advisedly. I'm being really serious. I interviewed you. So it's now, do the math, it's what, 40 years ago or something, you know, more. You're more interesting than you were then. I honestly believe this. You've seen a lot more.
Well, then I should be.
As another old timer,
you don't stop learning.
Yeah, but everybody tells you, you know, you're going to forget, and you don't know this, and you're slowing down, and so forth. The fact is, you have not slowed down. You really have not. I mean, I'm not bullshitting you. And I've talked to you many times over the years. You've never been better than you are now. At least my experience with you.
I want you to phone my home and tell my wife that.
Yeah. You do the same with my wife. We all know that. But the point is, you know, okay, but you're up against the reality, okay, because we've lost that faith in traditional religion, primitive religion, fundamentalist religion. I don't know if any of them believe it or they wouldn't do what they say anyway. I mean, it's a question I had about a lot of the religious right. If you really believe you're going to be judged and you've read the, you know, the parable of the Good Samaritan in Luke, you know, something doesn't connect here, you know, because Jesus tells you in the parable of the Good Samaritan, you better worry about that other when they're not in your tribe. Mm-hmm. And you know, and you better pick them up and take care of them, take them to the inn and feed them. And that's how you will be judged, whether you're going to have this eternal life. Well, by that standard, you're certainly going to have an eternal life. But I suspect you don't fully subscribe to what might be a more simple view of a fundamentalist religion. You are 95, okay? And I'm asking you a question I ask myself. I'm 81, so I'm not, you know, I can't give myself, I haven't had a few operations and so forth, so I understand about mortality. How do you deal with mortality? How do you deal with, it's one thing we haven't learned anything more about, right? Science has not helped us. We had the eclipse. We now believe in the eclipse. We're not.
I have thought for a long while. I'll express it this way right now, but it's been in my mind this way for a long time. The fact of my life and yours is that it's taken me, in my case, it's taken me 95 years, a number of months, weeks, days, hours, and so forth, to see you just shift your weight in that chair, to look at you right now and hear my voice. Saying exactly what I'm saying. And as the seconds tick off, it's taken me every fucking second of 95 plus years to hear myself say this. So is living in the moment important or what? Now, it has taken everybody who hears me say this, every split second of their lives to hear me say it. Are we connected or what? I love thinking about that. I love thinking about that.
Are you have fear about?
It's gotten to a place where it feels like bragging to say you don't fear it. It's a wonder that as much as we know scientifically, as much as we've learned, as much as we continue to learn day by day, we have no guess as to what happens at the conclusion of this game we're playing. Nobody's ever come back. Do we rest? Do we go on? My wife will give you chapter and verse about what she believes will follow. But at the core of what she believes is faith. Nobody's proved it. I can't get there in any direction. As much as I've heard, as we've all heard, about it's this, it's that. But I'm totally satisfied with the wonder of not knowing. I think there's something gorgeous about that.
Wow. Norman Lear, an American original.
We're all originals.
Ah, but you're a special one. Ralph.
There's nobody could interview me the way you do. Jesus Christ. It's nice to be loved.
I'm in awe, I must say. I really am, Norman. I've interviewed a hell of a lot of people in this world, I've known you for a long time, and I mean, it's just,
you know, part, you know what I
you
think?
Still give a shit. I mean, the amazing thing, okay? I you know, as a journalist, everybody gives you a line. I've interviewed Fidel Castro. I interviewed Ronald Reagan. I mean, I've interviewed, you know, Gorbachev. I mean, I've interviewed good, the bad, the ugly. All over the world. And there's always this big bullshit factor. There's always this self-glorification. There's always layering on, and another plan, and not taking a position, positioning yourself. I mean, you know, it's always there, you know, and you spend hours trying to get with you. And I've known you, as I said, when I went to see interview you back there in the 70s, and I've known you forever. You have gotten along with you have a great bullshit detector about yourself. That's now maybe that informed your comedy. It informed your, you know, not maybe, it definitely.
You know, I think that comes from, I've never been afraid of saying I don't know or indicating I don't know. You know, I've never felt I had anything to prove except doing what I do as well as I can do it.
That's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence, where the intelligence certainly came at a very high level from Norman Lear. Our producers are Rebecca Mooney and Josh Shear. Our engineers are Kat Ure and Mario Diaz. And we're broadcasting from KCRW in Santa Monica, and next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence.